Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I was privileged to have this week what I guess you might call an intelligence briefing, albeit unclassified, by our first guest. He is Richard Fisher, a man now with quite a considerable reputation both in the United States and internationally for his insights into Chinese military activities and intentions. He is a senior fellow on Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center and has written extensively and for many years about the Chinese and their ambitions and the implications for us, notably in his recent book, China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. I wanted to talk with him in particular in light of the latest developments with respect to North Korea, China's, proxy. Some have actually called it a sock puppet. I'm pleased to have Rick Fisher here to do just that. Rick, welcome. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you, Frank.
So I would like to start with the question. We have for many, many years, as you know, had successive governments, both Republican and Democratic in this country, perceiving North Korea as very much a separate entity from China, and as a result, constantly turning to the Chinese for help to us with dealing with the increasingly serious problems that are emanating from North Korea. I gather you have a rather different take on the relationship between China and North Korea. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Rick.
North Korea is a proxy of China, just like Pakistan and Iran are proxies. China has ensured that that North Korea, Pakistan, and Iran will have armed with nuclear ballistic missiles. Iran and North Korea are on the cusp of this capability. China does this because they are completely aligned politically. They are against democracy. They are against the United States. They are actively targeting allies of the United States, and they are trying to destroy American alliances in their regions.
Well, let me just ask you, this does stand in stark contrast, of course, to the whole notion that China is our major training partner and therefore has a great investment in the United States and would not want any harm to come to the United States and is an emerging power whose peaceful rise is very much their policy as well as our hope. You would, I gather, say none of that is true.
No, it is not. China is using a very wide and deep economic, student, technology, education relationship with the United States to build up its strength. And it's pretty much about to reach a point where it may not require us. It's already reached the point where it really doesn't require the help, military technical help from Russia, but it still wants access to new Russian ideas and new Russian things. Pretty soon, we will not be as useful to the Chinese, and they'll start to push us around even more, actually undertaking military campaigns, perhaps against Taiwan, perhaps to sew up the South China Sea. Today, North Korea is the tip of the spear, so to speak, the nuclear spear, and North Korea is being used to diminish our alliance relationship with South Korea, to divide our alliance relationship with Japan, so China can better isolate and control these two important countries.
This is fascinating, Rick. But when you look at some of the Chinese help that has been given to the North Koreans it really underscores this point that they're not independent actors. The North Koreans are not doing things the Chinese find unacceptable, for sure, and that indeed the Chinese are enabling the threat to us. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, in specific terms.
North Korea could not conduct a surprise missile strike against the United States without the help from China that it has received for almost a decade to make these new liquid fuel ICBMs and imminent future solid fuel ICBMs mobile so that they can quickly leave their protective layers, reach their launch positions, and start their missions. The United States has known of China's direct assistance to this North Korean capability since at least August 2011, and the United States has not highlighted this assistance publicly once, and it has not sanctioned any of the companies that are now involved in making China's nuclear missiles mobile and thus more able to kill Americans in American cities.
Rick, speaking of sanctions, as you know, the president did announce yesterday some rather sweeping, I believe long overdue, financial sanctions on banks and other financial institutions doing business with North Korea. And the Chinese responded essentially immediately by telling their banks, at least publicly, to not do business with the North Koreans. This seems to at least have coincided with, if not prompted, the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un to threaten to detonate an H-bomb. Is this something that could be done without the acquiescence or at least the help to this point of the Chinese?
The Chinese can't stop it, and privately they would applaud it. I mean, the Chinese tested their first H-bomb after having launched it on a ballistic missile back in, I believe it was 1966. So the North Koreans would actually be following the Chinese example. And I think we're also going to see, if not before an atmospheric nuclear missile test, a test of a multiple warhead capable ICBM. That technology has also probably made its way either via Pakistan or directly to North Korea from China.
Rick, if indeed the North Koreans were to test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere, would that measurably affect the strategic situation in the region? For that matter, what kind of collateral effects might it have from an electromagnetic pulse attack?
That is a huge and important question, Frank, and it really depends on where the charge lands. If it is in an isolated enough spot in the Pacific, then the unfortunate ships that happen to be passing through that region will probably be the only victims, plus a lot of fish. However, the region will then be looking at the American response. And an atmospheric nuclear test really makes it long overdue that the United States redeploy tactical nuclear weapons to the region and also begin the active embargo of North Korea, and to include the interdiction of the pipelines, the oil pipelines that run between China and North Korea.
Very strong stuff, needless to say. Rick Fisher, the Chinese, it seems to me, are now at a point where these kinds of activities by the North Koreans are increasingly going to be having a negative consequence for them. There was reports, I think you may have alluded to them at one point recently, that radioactive fallout migrated from the recent underground test by the North Koreans of their first H-bomb over China. I'm just wondering very quickly whether you think the Chinese may feel the need not simply to stop doing business with the North Koreans. I'm hoping that will be the minimum here, but actually to effect a change in the regime.
I don't think so, Frank. The only point at which the Chinese will intervene to that level is to forestall an actual joint South Korean-American invasion of North Korea. And by that time, what we will have done is not end a threat, but we will have marched North Korea down the road towards becoming a province of China, because a Chinese-directed transition puts North Korea on the road to becoming a province of China.
Well, I think effectively that may be where we are already, but we'll see. We'll be watching it closely. Rick Fisher, thank you for the extraordinary work you do. I'm appreciative of you joining us from time to time to talk about it, and we look forward to doing so with you in the near future. Meantime, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz, one of your admirers, about some of the reporting he's done on that work. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Bill Gertz takes us inside the ring.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined for our weekly visit inside the ring with Bill Gertz, our tour guide, the author of a prize-winning column at the Washington Times of that name. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
Let me ask you about something we discussed a moment ago with your friend and mine, Rick Fisher. You reported on some of the work that he has been doing, sort of dot connecting, about Chinese military assistance that has been enabling the North Korean threat to the United States. I gather you found that persuasive, as have I.
Yeah, I had a piece in my Inside the Ring column this week that looked at this new intermediate-range ballistic missile called the Hwasong 12. It was test-fired over Japan in one of the recent provocations just this month. What's interesting about this new missile is that it's mobile. It's on a road mobile transport erector launcher, and a photo analysis that I did shows that this launcher was very likely from China. And the reason we know that is because back in 1999, U.S. intelligence photographed a Mas launcher from Belarus outside of a Chinese factory. So, and this was identical to the type of launcher that was shown in the missile firing just last week. So it's clear that the Chinese were able to reverse engineer this very heavy-duty 16-wheel launcher and convert it into a missile-firing launcher. And again, the administration has just imposed new sanctions. They appear focused on banks, but these are clear violations of all of the UN sanctions.
But Bill, at the end of the day, you're not suggesting, I know, that these companies are doing anything other than what the government of China directed them to do, right? I mean, it's not as though they're free actors in transferring this kind of military technology to North Korea, are they?
No, they're state-owned companies, for sure. But I think it's critically important that they single out those companies because in the final analysis, these are extremely militarily significant strategic transfers of technology and equipment.
Speaking of which, Bill, you've reported on a new gambit by the Chinese communists to reassert or retool maybe their outrageous claims to control and to exercise sovereign authority over the South China Sea. Talk a little bit about this so-called Four Sha gambit.
Yeah, this is a very important story. This was in the Free Beacon this week, and it's based on a closed-door meeting between U.S. and Chinese officials in Boston between August 28th and 29th. And it was during this meeting that a senior Chinese official came forth with a new, what has been termed, lawfare tactic. This is the use of legal means for covert strategic purposes, and the Chinese lost out. They used to have what was called the nine-dash line that covered 90% of the South China Sea. The Permanent Court of Arbitration and International Tribunal last year basically said that was illegal. So now the Chinese have switched tactics, and they have identified 4 island groups, which they call Sha, or sand in Chinese, that they are now claiming is Chinese territory and waters, and all of the adjacent areas, as well as continental shelf, as well as exclusive economic zones. A number of legal methods are being used to claim this. I was really surprised that the State Department at first, they just wanted to decline to comment. One wiseacre public affairs guy told me to contact the Chinese government. And I said, that's not acceptable. I said, this is an important issue. The State Department should be pushing back against this illegal claim, this lawfare claim. And at least I was able to get a statement that the U.S. would do that.
Bill Gertz, this idea of taking over these islands that they've manufactured out of sand, basically, and then essentially using the claim of territorial waters and continental shelves and so on, essentially gives them the same thing that they were going to have under the nine-dash line, does it not?
Absolutely. It's just a new legal tactic dressed up in a different terminology. And of course, they're taking advantage of the fact that the U.S. is very distracted with North Korea, and they're just moving into this strategic waterway, which, again, is extremely important from a trade standpoint. Anywhere from $3 to $5 trillion annually passes through there. So China taking over the South China Sea is a real dangerous gambit.
But this really goes back to the point that we were talking about with Rick earlier and to some extent in our previous conversations, Bill. And that is, if China is actually calling the shots with respect to what the North Koreans do and enabling them to do the sort of threatening things that are preoccupying us at the moment, it probably is no accident, comrade, as the communists are fond of saying, that we're watching our preoccupation with the shiny dangling object of the North Korean threat at the same time the Chinese are essentially locking down their claims on the South China Sea with all that that portends. Bill, I did want to just ask you quickly for your professional assessment of what it might mean were the North Koreans to execute the threat that they've now made to detonate a hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real threat, and it's going to challenge the Trump administration to really put up or shut up in terms of really taking action either against these missiles or against North Korea. I think it's a dangerous threat on the part of Pyongyang that if they were to fire a missile and do an atmospheric test of a hydrogen bomb, I mean, the implications of that are pretty dire.
Bill, very quickly, one other thing that you have been focusing on, I know that is of concern, and especially in this very context, is the fact that we have had several of our warships taken out, at least for a protracted period of time, including two of our most sophisticated anti-missile ships, the Aegis-class ships, by collisions. And you have been reporting on speculation that that may, in fact, again, have been no accident. What's the latest on that front?
Yes, Navy investigators' preliminary conclusion now is that the reason that this happened was that there was a steering failure on the most recent collision, the USS John S. McCain, that the crew failed to properly handle it. It sounds like a combination of a lack of readiness as well as major human error that caused this deadly collision. Again, an oil tanker collided into the ship and killed seven sailors on board. What happened was that somehow or other, the steering, electrical steering went down. And when you're in busy waters, as they were at the Strait of Malacca, you're supposed to have the secondary or manual steering, which is in the aft of the ship, the stern, manned up and ready to go. And apparently this didn't happen. So that's one of the things that's being looked at. Now, they've also sent a cybersecurity team out there. They've pretty much ruled out that it was an external cyber attack. But the Navy is very concerned that that could happen in the future, that a commercial ship could be hacked and driven into a warship.
And we'll be, again, awaiting further reporting by you on this subject, as the possibility that this could not be accidental is something that I think has to preoccupy all of us, especially given the small size of the fleet we have to rely upon at a moment like this in the South and East and other parts of the Western Pacific region. The South China Sea, the East China Sea, and other parts of the Western Pacific region. Bill Gertz, again, thank you so much for your time, for the great job you do at the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon. Again, I commend to all of you, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Liz Yore about the latest developments on the front of female genital mutilation in the United States. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Liz Yore. She is an attorney by training. She has spent most of her professional life working in the field of trying to prevent child abuse and other human rights, countering human trafficking. She's been the general counsel for the Illinois Child Protective Services and worked at federal levels as well. In this battle space, she is these days heading up a campaign called End FGM Today. FGM, of course, standing for Female Genital Mutilation. I admire her greatly and applaud as well as support the important work she's about now. Liz Yore, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Oh, thank you, Frank. I'm delighted to be with you.
Let's just again to help those who have not been exposed to the horrors of this, just take a minute to talk about what female genital mutilation entails and who is perpetrating it in particular in this country.
Yes, it's the fastest growing import into the United States. Female genital mutilation is an ancient barbaric practice by both Muslims and ancient Christian sects and tribal customs in Africa. It is literally cutting the clitoris out of the genitals of little girls. The purpose of FGM in the Islamic world, as well as in these other cultures, is to suppress sexuality, basically to kill the sex drive of a little girl into her adulthood. And the purpose is for quote-unquote purity. This practice has existed, certainly not in the United States, but is now being imported into the United States through the massive refugee resettlement program. And so we now find, according to the CDC, over 500,000 women and girls at risk of FGM in the United States. Shocking. And Frank, I think that is woefully underreported. And I think we're looking at huge numbers in the United States just based on the number of refugees coming in from Muslim countries that have 98-97% of the women who are cut under FGM.
Now, Liz, you have been following very closely a federal prosecution, the first, as I understand it, under federal statutes prohibiting female genital mutilation in the state of Michigan. Tell us the key pieces of this and report on a recent development in that case.
Sure. Your listeners should know that in 1996, the feds criminalized FGM in the United States. It has taken 21 years to uncover this practice in the United States. And it happened in Michigan, where federal prosecutors indicted a doctor, a Muslim doctor from the Dawoodi Bohra tribe in India, who was trained at Johns Hopkins. This woman has been charged with conspiracy to mutilate, mutilation, lying to federal agents, as well as obstruction of justice. And the way that this was uncovered is two mothers from Minnesota, part of the same Dawoodi Muslim sect, a Shia sect, traveled to Michigan to this doctor to have her mutilate their 2 7-year-old daughters. As a result, in April, there was an indictment. We continue to see superseding indictments, which means additional victims are being charged. And last week, we had also two mothers, the mothers who had traveled from Minnesota to Michigan, also charged under this federal indictment. It is a breakthrough case that is going to shine the light, not only for the country to begin to understand this underground network, this trafficking network, quite frankly, of Muslim mothers trafficking their little girls across state lines to identified mutilators who will impose this horrendous procedure on their little girls.
Now, Liz Yor, I'm told that there are 22 of these Dawoodi Bora sect mosques across the United States. Is that the likely exclusive source of this female genital mutilation?
Well, we know the Dawoodis mandate FGM, but we also know, Frank, that in countries in Somalia, for example, and we have over 100,000 Somali refugees in the United States. Somalis, 98% of Somali women and little girls undergo FGM. So as a result of that, we know that it's not strictly limited to Dawoodi Bora sects, but also to Muslims who have been coming over from their countries and importing with them this horrendous practice.
Right. Let me ask you a couple of quick questions, Liz, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of topics to discuss here. Is there a danger in your professional judgment of flight risk on the part of this doctor who has now been released with a very, very high bail, to be sure, apparently supplied by lots of people in her community, which really speaks to the support that this female genital mutilation enjoys in the Dawoodi Bora sect?
Yes, it does. $4.5 million bond. 17 people put up their homes or money, bank accounts as collateral, and many of them from around the country and part of this Mas Dawoodi Bora sect. So, yes, it does show a great deal of support for what she actually did, which is very, very troubling.
And are you concerned that she may flee the country despite efforts to keep her under effectively house arrest?
I am, Frank, for a couple of reasons. One, she's facing a life imprisonment charge if she's convicted. Secondly, her previous behavior running up through this investigation and up to her arrest, she demonstrated a total lack in regard and respect for the rule of law. When she was arrested, she was at Detroit International Airport boarding a flight to Kenya.
Yeah, that's a clue. Liz, one of the justifications that is being offered by the defense in this prosecution under the federal statute up in Michigan, as you know, is that this is simply the practice of religious freedom. Is that something that you find tenable or that we should find acceptable?
This is why we have to have a discussion about this. You know, in our country, Frank, the U.S. Congress determined that the government will step in when children are being abused. We draw the line. And for example, cult leaders, religious leaders who sexually abuse or physically abuse children in the name of religion were not tolerated in this country. For example, David Koresh, Warren Jeffs. And we did not tolerate, nor should we tolerate it in the name of the Muslim religion.
Right. We've had people proposing a sacrifice of young virgins. I mean, that isn't countenanced either, needless to say, under religious freedom. Liz, one of the things I know your End FGM Today campaign has been focusing on is trying to help state legislators enact legislation sort of as counterparts to that of the federal government. Why is that important?
Well, we have, you know, a federal law, but we only have 25 states, Frank, that have criminalized FGM. And why that is so critical is that the state has far more resources than the federal government with respect to prosecuting these cases. For example, Illinois has 101 counties, 101 district attorneys and law enforcement and police departments that can be used to investigate these crimes.
And we really need them to be doing that, as this Dawoodi Bora case suggests. Liz, we are out of time. I did want to give you an opportunity, though, to promote the FBI hotline for people who have tips about what's going on here or would like to report suspicious behavior.
Yes, the Call FBI hotline is really being advertised around the country to call the FBI hotline or call your local FBI office.
Well, let me give the number here. It's 800-CALL-FBI, and the website is fbi.gov/FGM. Check it out, folks, and check out the great work that Liz Yore does at endfgmtoday.com. Liz, thank you for that work. Thank you for coming on with periodic updates about it. We appreciate it tremendously and wish you all the best. Next up, we will speak with Trevor Loudon about the dangers we are now facing from Antifa and their threat to our freedoms. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Trevor Loudon, a Renaissance man, I think, out of New Zealand. He is the author of trevorloudon.com, a terrific blog. He has been incredibly effective in multiple media platforms as an author, as a movie maker, as a, well, commentator and pundit. He's an extraordinary resource, in particular, on the challenge we face here in the United States from what I think of as the red-green axis, specifically the deep penetration of our institutions, government, country, by the radical left and their unlikely but very real Islamist or Sharia supremacist allies. He has most recently produced a new film, America Under Siege, Antifa, and it will be out shortly online as well as, I think, in select theaters. He has come to share with us insights about the Antifa movement and, more generally, the fate of the free world. Trevor Loudon, thank you so much for joining. It's good to catch up with you, sir.
No, it's great to be on, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what your research and now new film is disclosing about this group. We've seen their masked faces violently setting upon people who they oppose, typically from the right. Discuss their roots and how serious a problem they represent.
Yeah, I regard them as very serious. If you trace the roots of Antifa, it really goes back to Leon Trotsky. He used similar units before the Bolshevik Revolution to suppress opposition to communism. Where Antifa got its name was in fascist Italy, the units fighting the fascists. They were set up by Trotsky, as they were also set up in pre-Nazi Germany to battle on the streets against Hitler's brown shirts. And interestingly, when the brown shirts prevailed, a whole bunch of Antifa and German communists switched over to the brown shirts. They really were birds of a feather. They were two street gangs fighting for supremacy. And the whole point is Antifa is not an independent actor. Antifa has always been backed by the communist movement. And today in America, we've found numerous connections between Antifa and the unions and Antifa and the Democratic Party. So just as they were used as a tool by the German Communist Party back in the 30s, they are now used by the radical left, by the more mainstream left here, to suppress opposition. And we've found that virtually all major Antifa violence, whether in Boston or Washington, D.C., Charlottesville, Virginia, Portland, Oregon, Berkeley, San Francisco, Oakland, California, are all in areas where the local government is controlled by the far left of the Democratic Party. And in every one of those areas, the police have been basically told to stand down while Antifa does its business.
Yeah, we certainly saw that visit quite memorably in Charlottesville. And in fact, I wanted to ask you, in addition to what they've been doing on campuses like Berkeley and in the streets, as in Charlottesville, what they're doing in the Congress, this Antifa movement and their allies. And partly, if you'd talk about this in the context of some of your previous work, notably your documentary, The Enemies Within, and your comprehensive treatment of this in your book, The Enemies Within, Communists, Socialists, and Progressives in the U.S. Congress. I'm specifically interested, Trevor Loudon, in the recent enactment of a joint resolution known as Senate Joint Resolution 47, now Public Law 11548, which gave Antifa a complete pass. Connect some dots here for us, if you would.
Antifa are a tool by much more powerful forces. And as you well know, there is a concerted effort by the radical left and the Islamist movement to shut down free speech, to basically shut down the First Amendment in America. Because they saw in the last election that if Americans are left to their own devices and actually have information, they don't vote the way the left and Islamists want. So you had a resolution which was moved by Kamala Harris from California, a far leftist, but also by Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida. And that resolution was written by a leading activist with Engage USA, formerly known as Emerge USA, a major Islamist organization. And so this was adopted by the entire U.S. Senate, which is basically a foot in the door for suppressing free speech in America.
You know, what's striking about this is that this stands in such stark contrast, Trevor Loudon, to what seemed to be the sentiments of the American people. There were two polls taken recently, one that we helped sponsor, I'm happy to say, by John McLaughlin and Associates, the other by Rasmussen. They came to essentially identical results when they were posing the question to those being surveyed, do you support freedom of speech even if it gives offense to some? And the poll results were, as you know, something on the order of 85 said yes, with only 8 saying no. So this really is seemingly exactly opposite of what the Congress has recently done with, I'm sorry to say, the involvement of the Republican leadership, as well as now the endorsement of the President of the United States. How do you think that the Antifa types and their allies on the radical left and among the Sharia supremacist groups are perceiving what's happening now? Will this be the end of it, or is this simply whetting their appetite for more totalitarian repression and transformation in our country?
Well, no, this is just a foot in the door, and we see this happening in Canada now where similar resolutions are basically on the way to making it an offence, to cause offence. And when you're talking Islamists, offence is not to lie about them or defame them. It may be simply to tell the truth about their activities or their beliefs.
And as you say, in Europe, saying the truth about these guys is not a defense, in fact, against the charge that you've been blaspheming or otherwise speaking unacceptably.
Yeah, look, you know, traditionally in the West, you know, there has always been an offense of slander or libel, but that is when you tell a lie about someone, a malicious lie to damage their reputation. This is taken to a whole new level. This is just causing offense. And who decides what's offensive? It is the person offended. And we know that Islamists have an extremely thin skin.
One might argue permanently offended, as a matter of fact. Trevor Loudon, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Please, folks, check out a wonderful resource, trevorloudon.com, a voice of reason and a warning to us all in this country from down under. He is now the driving force behind the narrator, the creative genius that is bringing us America Under Siege, Antifa. Tell us quickly, Trevor, how people can see your film next week.
Trailers are available online now. The movie's being released on the 25th at Free Speech Week in Berkeley. We're going to have the premiere. It'll be available online. All you have to do is Google America Under Siege Antifa, and you'll find it easily. Or you can also go to the website of the Capital Research Network, who are sponsoring the movie and funding the movie, and it will be available on their site. But very simply, America Under Siege Antifa. Go look for it after the 25th.
Wonderful. Trevor Loudon, thank you so much. Safe travels there to Berkeley. Godspeed. We'll talk with you again in the very near future, I'm sure. I'm hoping we'll talk with the rest of you again next week. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.